A young woman poet was speaking to a noted male poet at a party. Young women shouldn't write poems, he told her. They are poems. The young woman was a friend of poet Adrienne Rich, and Rich has used that story as an example of what women poets were up against in the 1950s and 60s when she was getting established. Rich went on to become one of the first widely published contemporary feminist poets. Her work held a special place for many women readers who were looking for poems that related to their lives, and to many women poets looking for signs of encouragement. In the 1950s, when she was in her 20s, Rich had several collections of poems published, but in that decade she gave birth to three sons and felt constantly torn between her literary ambitions and family responsibilities. She's addressed that in her poems and in her book Of Woman Born, Motherhood as Experience and Institution. In the introduction to the book, she wrote, "We need to understand the power and powerlessness embodied in motherhood in patriarchal culture." Since becoming a lesbian feminist, Rich has tried to help define alternatives to patriarchal values. Adrienne Rich has a new collection of poems called Time's Power.
I picked the title of this book, which is a phrase from a poem in it, because it seemed to me that the poems were, to some extent, the product of a greater consciousness about time, a consciousness coming not only from growing older, but from the sense of the brevity of so many lives of people I've cared about. Young people cut off in their 20s, 30s, early 40s by AIDS, by cancer, by violence. And that sense of living into one's 60s as almost a privilege in a time like this, the perspectives that that can give you, the time to see your own life and work unfold, to see your see the history of your time unfolding, that seems to me more and more a very precious thing.
I'd like for you to read the first two stanzas from the opening poem in Time's Power, and the poem is called Sofeggiero. Feel free to introduce this in any way if you'd like.
Well, the title Solfeggietto is the title of a once famous piano piece that was studied by many young piano students, including myself, when I was growing up. And the poem is a dialogue, or it's a monologue, really, of a daughter to her mother, a daughter who has studied music with her mother, also a musician. I see the poem as an attempt to take further some of the perceptions, some of the perspectives on that much discussed, much analyzed relationship, which I've written about a great deal. Solfeggietto. Your windfall at 15, your Steinway grand, paid for by fire insurance, came to me as birthright, a black cave with teeth of ebony and ivory, twanging and thundering over the head of the crawling child until that child was set on the big book on the chair to face the keyboard world of black and white, already knowing the world was black and white. The child's hands, smaller than a sand dollar, set on the keys, wired to their mysteries. The child's wits facing the ruled and ruling staves. For years we battled over music lessons, mine taught by you, nor did I wonder what that keyboard meant to you, the hours of solitude, the practicing, your life of prize recitals, lifted hopes, Piatti's nephew praising you at 16, scholarships to the north, or what it was to teach boarding school girls what won't be used, shelving ambition beating time to On the Ice at Sweetbriar, or The Sunken Cathedral, for a child counting the minutes and the scales to freedom.
You know, in that poem, you have the expression shelving ambition. I believe your mother put her performance career on hold to have a family.
Yes, that's true. My mother was trained as a concert pianist and as a composer, and ceased to work in any sense publicly in either of those fields after she married. However, I guess I'd like to say that this is not simply a poem about my mother mm-hmm. and myself. I'm very much interested in the place of biography in poetry and in fiction, but I'm also interested in the place of fiction in poetry. And I think that there's a tendency at present to read poems as autobiographical statements, documents, narratives, and to miss, therefore, a great deal that's going on in them if you ascribe each event to some actual event, if you ascribe each image, each situation, each relationship to some literal occasion. It seems to me that you run the risk of missing not only the poetry, but the fuller, richer, deeper aspects of the poem, which come not necessarily from the poet's biography, but from what the poet has seen, heard, drawn into herself or himself from other lives.
Mm-hmm. I want to quote a line from Solfeggietto that's in a stanza that we didn't get to, and that is, "The mother cannot teach the daughter because this is not the story of a mother teaching magic to her daughter." I really like that line, and I can explain why. Stories about magical mothers and magical daughters and magical women somehow seem to leave me out. I always feel left out of those because mm-hmm. I don't feel like a very magical person. And it always seems to me that if being a woman entails having a certain amount of magic, then what does that make me? I'm not the magical type. Does that make me less of a woman? Do you know mm-hmm. what I mean?
Yes. Well, I think in writing those lines, I too was thinking about the tendency to mythologize the mother-daughter relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, I feel that I myself have participated in that in some of my earlier work. I think that it is perhaps that tendency that we have to try to correct the mythologies that we feel have harmed us, the mythologies that deny the strengths and the powers that women have passed on to women, that mothers have transmitted to daughters. And these are very real, and we know that they are very real. But at the same time, there are other stories. And I feel as though there needs to be a corrective to the corrective, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
We tried in the early years of the feminist movement to look under and behind the myths, the legends, that always depicted the stepmother, for instance, as cruel, the bad mother. The myths in popular psychology of the evil mother, the evil mother-daughter bond. We tried to correct those, and in so doing, I think we unearthed a great deal that was real and important and useful at the same time, as you say, to idealize, to sentimentalize, to mythologize that, those powers, those strengths, those those teachings takes us into yet another place where I think we are disempowered.
Well, did you ever feel that in wanting to celebrate women and being a woman, that you risked having that interfere with honesty, because there's so much ambiguity and ambivalence when you really look honestly at just about anything? And I think it's really the job of a poet to be very honest.
I agree with you. But I've never felt, I think that I when I said that I had participated in this mythologizing, I think that I participated in it perhaps in some poems, but mostly in prose, and that essentially poetry, if it is poetry, does not lend itself to simple readings, to oversimplifications, although people may try to read it that way. It seems to me that the essential nature of a poem is that there is ambivalence and ambiguity quivering underneath, and that there is tension, there is contradiction. That is of the very essence of poetry.
Adrienne Rich, I'd like for you to read another poem. This poem dates back to 1972. It's called From a Survivor, and it's both a poem, I think, about the difficulty of lasting relationships, and it's also a poem about a suicide.
From a Survivor. The pact that we made was the ordinary pact of men and women in those days. I don't know who we thought we were, that our personalities could resist the failures of the race. Lucky or unlucky, we didn't know the race had failures of that order and that we were going to share them. Like everybody else, we thought of ourselves as special. Your body is as vivid to me as it ever was, even more, since my feeling for it is clearer. I know what it could do and could not do. It is no longer the body of a god or anything with power over my life. Next year it would have been 20 years, and you are wastefully dead. Who might have made the leap we talked too late of making, which I live now, not as a leap, but a succession of brief, amazing movements, each one making possible the next.
Tell me if this is too personal, but I know your husband committed suicide in 1970.
Yeah, I don't really think that that's appropriate.
Okay. I think the 1970s were for you a period of great change. You became a radical feminist, and you also came out. I was wondering if, at that time, you saw lesbianism as both a political as well as a sexual choice.
I'm one of the lesbians who came out through the women's movement. And I don't mean that I wouldn't have come out if there had been no women's movement, but it's very hard to imagine the world without the women's liberation movement at this point. However, in my own history, that was the point. And it was a time of tremendous intensity among women of all kinds, women who had known they were lesbians all their lives, women who were then coming out, women who were then and have remained heterosexual. There was a kind of intensity around the politics that was very profound and passionate. It was very moving and very exciting to see women taking hold of their strength and taking hold of each other's strength and bringing out the power in each other, as was happening in that collective movement or movements of women. And the passion was political and the politics was passionate. And I think that would have to be my answer to your question. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was very sexual, and it was also in a milieu and in a time which was very political.
Poet Adrienne Rich is my guest. I want to talk with you a little bit about love poems. You once said that male poets, even men who are politically or aesthetically radical, tend to sentimentalize sexuality in love poems. And I'd like for you to explain that, perhaps offer an example of what you mean. And this is a statement
I don't
want to
pick out
ago.
An example this point, but what I was trying to talk about was the appearance of the woman in male poetry as occupying a certain kind of space, asleep on a bed, dead, as muse, as prophetess perhaps, as occupying some kind of rather mystical or else purely sexual zone. Women living the fullness of their lives are not usually found in poetry by men. They are seen in relation to the male poet. And I think that that is less true in poetry by women about men. I couldn't prove that, but I think it is less true. I think that there is a good deal more realism about the nature of the relationship between the sexes.
Mm-hmm. Now, in one of your earlier poems from your collection, Diving into the Wreck, you have a poem called Translations. And there's a line in that poem that says, "She's a woman of my time, obsessed with love, our subject. Mm-hmm. We've trained it like ivy to our walls." Yet, I have to say, I don't think you've written many love poems yourself.
Well, not all love poems are obvious as such, shall we say.
Uh-huh. Well, you actually
what
have...
What is a love poem, anyway?
Well,
I've just been reading the manuscript of an incredible volume coming out in January by the Southern poet Minnie Bruce Pratt called Crime Against Nature. It's a book of poems which have to do with the removal from her custody of her sons by her husband because she is a lesbian. And I have thought about these poems as some of the most passionate love poems I have ever read. They happen to be to her sons and about her sons.
Well, you have a poem called Love Poem in your new collection, Time's Power, and I'd like for you to read it.
Love Poem. Tell me, Bristler, where do you get such hair? So quick a flare, so strong a tongue. Green eyes, fierce curls, there and here a mole, a girl's dimples, a warrior's mind. Dark blood under gold skin, testing the world, the word. And so to write for you a pretty sonnet would be untrue. To your mud river flashing over rocks, your delicate coffee bushes, and more I cannot know, and some I labor with. And I mean to stay true, even in poems, to you. But there's something more. Beauty, when you were young, we both thought we were young. Now that's all done. We're serious now about death. We talk to her daily as to a neighbor. We're learning to be true with her. She has the keys to this house. If she must, she can sleep over.
I like the sense that love and the praise of love isn't necessarily the praise of physical beauty. It's beyond that, and that age changes that. And there's
It's also that a long lived relationship is about so many things.
Mm-hmm.
It is such a dense and complex process, always a process, and it's not to be summed up. It's not to be turned into some kind of vignette. And if we are serious, we also have to recognize that even the longest and richest and densest relationship must end, and that we see it around us, we see it in that inevitability of time's power, if you will. I would say that this poem, as much as this is a very compressed poem, and that it's as much a death poem as it is a love poem.
I want to ask you something. You've made it clear to me before the interview and a little bit during the course of the interview that you aren't that interested in talking autobiographically, that you'd rather keep your discussion to the work itself. And I guess I'd like to know why that's so, for a couple of reasons. One is that a lot of your poems are very personal, and also a lot of your essays have been autobiographical in nature. And also because of the, you know, one of the best-known early beliefs in feminism was that the personal is political.
I am very convinced that the personal is political, and that is why, certainly in my prose writings, I have been very directly autobiographical. On the other hand, it doesn't stop there. The personal doesn't automatically become the political. You have to make it so. You have to understand it so. Women have always, for example, talked with each other personally about their troubles with men, their problems in their marriages, their sorrows and joys in raising their children. These have not necessarily been political discussions. When consciousness raising began in the early days of the women's movement, it was not simply group therapy. It was carried on with a very deliberate political end, which was to extrapolate and generalize from these individual stories, to see larger patterns, to see how socially and politically these things could change. In the era of the 70s and 80s, I think we've seen a kind of vulgarization of that. We've seen an increasing fascination in the media with the private scandals of various people, celebrities created out of thin air, politicians, media stars. We've seen a kind of People magazine approach to journalism, even to criticism to some extent. And I feel as if I want to be a voice against the complete personalization of art and politics. We create art out of our struggle with and within a society. We make our politics out of our struggle with and within a society. We have our unique and individual experiences as people doing these things, but it doesn't rest with the individual and unique experience. There is the absolute necessity to make connections, and to make connections to the wider system, the wider structure that is constraining us, that is holding us back, that is oppressing us, if you will. And this, I feel, we see far too little. I also feel as if the criticism and reviewing of poetry right now is not what it needs to be, that there is very little understanding of a poem as a particular way of using language, a particular way of using images and physical sensations in language, a particular way of creating music through language, voices, dialogue, fictions. And the reading of a poem as ah, yes, in that year the poet met this person, did that, went here, went there, and now we can trace this in this poem. And we're going to read everything in the poem with reference to that. Means that you read the poem and miss a lot.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your poems.
Well, I've enjoyed it very much.